So when a girl who's 9 years old, she's capable of that, obviously she can get married to a 12-year-old boy, 13-year-old boy, 15-year-old boy. So there is no limit of age for the boys, obviously. So at least the boy should be 15 years old so that he can become father. Some, you know, some boys at age of 13 have those sperms, and obviously they have this age of puberty.
Like they've reached buluugh before
the,
even.
The puberty or buluugh, like they reach to this buluugh even before 15, when they're 13 years old. So it means that this, from this point of view, the, you know, we can say like from the point, the sexual point of view, they both are capable of becoming father and mother. And this is not something which is done by a religion. It is how Allah has made them.
It's a biological fact.
Yeah, it's a biological fact, and they're created this way.
Right.
They're created this way. Now, if you come and you make a law that before 18 years old, no one can marry, for example, or before 18 years, until they get 18 years, no one can have a boyfriend maybe, or they cannot get into the relation. These are the rules these are the rules that are made by humans.
Right.
It's not based on their biological facts that they have. They are capable of becoming, you know, mother or father before that age. So why generally, like in the West, there is a question, why Western has put the age of 18 for a person to become adult? Why they do not give the ID card or the driving license before the age of 18, you know?
Right.
There are many questions. Obviously, there are restrictions that in the West, I'm talking about the non-Islamic society, they cannot go towards the alcohol before 18 or 21 years old.
Right.
You know, there are different rules. Yeah.
Right.
It's because, you know, they think that according to them might be, you know, the people are getting, you know, mature at these ages. It's the age of maturity, maybe according to them. But when we talk about the age of puberty or the age of buluugh, actually, biologically it's different. It's 9 and 15, 9 and 13, like 9 in the girls.
Right.
And in some boys, it's 13, between 13 to 15, basically.
Right.
And if they don't have this puberty, then obviously they become baligh at least at age of 15. So this is a biological fact that they can.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. On the other side, obviously, we cannot find any script that stops a person from marrying like any age of person.
So there are no age restrictions in Islam, like old people should marry young people.
Not just Islam, in any religion you cannot find any age restrictions.
Right.
There is no restrictions. Okay? That's the other thing. So we need to basically see that why Islam allows a girl age 9. Now, there is another factor which we should not forget, that by the change of the time, the physique of the people is also changing. You know, people before us, they had the big physique, they were stronger, their food or the things which they used to eat was more pure. And, you know, at the age of even 9, we have in the history that they used to look like someone who's 27 years old.
Right.
You know,
right.
Physically, mentally, they were prepared at that time. Now, it's because of our daily routine. It's because of our food. Now, the thing which is changed is our routine is changed. The way we live, our lifestyle is changed. Why today they say, like, you're what you eat?
Right.
Yeah? Because you eat junk food, you become junk. Sorry to say that.
Right.
If you eat healthy food, you're healthy. Yeah. You are what you eat. and the circumstances, the environment, it has its own effects. So Islam or any religion, it's not just about the Islam. None of the religions or no one in the world has put any limitations of the age for marriage, obviously. And later the countries, yes, they have their rules. The parliaments, they have passed a rule or the law and due to that. But within the human societies, there was no restriction of any age. And if someone was capable of getting married, they used to marry the person, obviously. It is the capability that does this person is capable or not. Now, if people today, because of our food, because of our lifestyle, because of, you know, the routine that we have, if they think that if a girl is not capable of getting married at the age of 9, and she's capable of, for example, you know, nowadays it's 30s. People get married at 30s. Right. Not even 20s, not even 80s.
No, but they have multiple girlfriends and boyfriends before that.
Yeah, before that.
Right.
At the school, the girl itself has a boyfriend when she's at the school. And even before age of 9, yeah, sorry to say that. But we can see many examples, like a girl 6 years, 7 years old coming and saying to the dad or the family that I have a boyfriend and this is his name and all those.
Right.
And, you know, you can see the cartoons as well, how they're propagating this relation of boyfriend and girlfriend. Yes, marriage is something which is, you know, certified, or which makes a firm bound between these two people. But before that, I don't think so. Like, you know, no one has said, like, they don't have an issue about the boyfriend and girlfriend. Basically, the question should be, can at the early age, girl and boy become a boyfriend or girlfriend or not? Whereas we can see it starts from age 7 and keeps going on. And we also have seen that the grandpas who were until the age of 50 boyfriend and girlfriend and have children and obviously grandchildren, now they're getting married.
Right, yes, funny enough.
It's so funny.
Right.
Yeah, they have everything. Now, under which relation they had these kids?
Right.
Yeah, who allowed them? Is it just the society if they allow them that you can be a boyfriend or girlfriend, or you need to follow the actual way of having children, which is marriage? You should have a bond with each other so that you can have, you're responsible for each other and then have kids. So there are many questions on the other side for these people.
Say, just a point we can make here is that just because Islam allows something, it doesn't mean that you have to do it. There are circumstances that may mitigate why a 9-year-old girl may be married. Could you please mention a few examples of why this may be the case?
Of what?
Of a 9-year-old girl being married to someone. Because we also need to remember it is out of her own free will.
It depends on the society. For example, in some societies, the 9-year-old girls are very well grown up, and then we can see some examples. But obviously, on the other hand, we can see like the boys, they have the same age almost. It depends on the cultural things, on the societies, but it's not like Islam has said in any place that when your girls become 9 years old, get them married. We don't have such statement.
Right.
Okay, we don't have such statement. The historical factors are there. There are many at this time. Even we have, like, for example, if you go to Pakistan in the interior, you know, province of Sindh or Balochistan. You can find this if you go to India, where there's no Muslim. Yeah, within Hindus, you can see such thing happening. Within the, you know, Orthodox Christians or the European community, you can also see this. So you can find these things, but it all depends on the society and culture which they have. Is it, you know, allowable in their culture or not? But as you said, yes, Islam says that there is no limitation, and obviously it depends on the parents. Yes, Islam talks about the capability, whether is she capable or not, and the guy who's you're selecting, is he kufr, is he a real partner according to the age, according to the, you know, intellect and the being religious, does he match the girl or not? This is on the parents.
Right. And with that, dear Sayyid, we will have to end today's program. I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in.
إِنَّ فِي الْجَنَّةِ نَهْرًا لَبَنْ إِنَّ فِي الْجَنَّةِ نَهْرًا لَبَنْ عَلِيٍّ وَحُسَيْنٍ وَحَسَنٍ
يوسف جلالي بتهوان
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayyid Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the US and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stressed that they would not back down.
Akid.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China, and the US favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the US has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints, and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
In Guzarakis, authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full. After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahan Abbott, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, 4 countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCEAR in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the US. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many U.N. resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
As Afghans witnessed their most difficult days, the 12th round of Iranian aid to Afghanistan arrived in Kabul. These batches, including 5 tons of medicines and 5 tons of food, are meant to treat injuries and be distributed to the families of victims of Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Iran's been sending a series of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the beginning of the recent crisis in the country, at the recommendation of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to help our brothers. This current shipment will target those who were injured and lost their beloved ones in the recent Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Taliban officials welcome emergency aid to the country and thank those who stay by the Afghan side in the darkest days. People suffering from poverty and difficulties await more help from the world countries.
We thank Iran for its humanitarian aid to our people. May God give them in return. Iranian aids have always been on time, especially when they helped us with emergency aid after 2 large mosque blasts. Today, our people in a critical situation and need help. So the world countries should help us and free our frozen assets. The recent crisis largely affected our poor people. We don't have anything to eat or treat our patients. My brother is injured. Now he is under treatment here. Neither the hospital has enough medicines, nor do we have enough money to buy them from outside.
At least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded when Daesh terrorist gunmen attacked the 400-bed Sardar Muhammad Daud Khan Hospital after two heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. Daesh attacks come as hunger crises are looming in the country. Some countries, including Iran, have been sending shipments of aid. However, to address the problem of hunger in Afghanistan, more international assistance is needed. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Tzipi Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of rights?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as a Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger. Robert Carter, London.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity, while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades.
both countries claim the region in full but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a three-day maneuver, codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the four branches of the Iranian army and was held over a million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The three-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion, and that nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 2001. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Quilley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Estimated Cost of Post-9/11 U.S. Wars Hits $8 Trillion with Nearly a Million People Dead. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. With the final U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of occupation and war, a new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion, and that nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 2001. What about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone strike in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? Dr. Maha Helal, Justice for Muslim Collective, said. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, which has been releasing reports on the financial and human costs of the post-9/11 wars at regular intervals since 2010, the total cost of the war and military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and elsewhere over the last two decades have directly killed at least 897,000 to 929,000 people. An estimate, the researchers say, is conservative. Dr. Nita Crawford, co-director of the Cost of War Project, in a statement said, "The deaths we tallied are likely a vast undercount of the true toll these wars have taken on human life. It's critical we properly account for the vast and varied consequences of the many U.S. wars and counterterror operations since 9/11, as we pause and reflect on all of the lives lost." The study calculates that of the $8 trillion estimated cost in the wars waged by the United States regime since 9/11, $2.3 trillion is attributed to the Afghanistan-Pakistan war zone, $2.1 trillion is attributed to the Iraq-Syria war zone, and $355 billion was attributed to other battlefields, including Libya, Somalia, and elsewhere. Above those figures, another $1.1 trillion was spent on homeland security programs, and $2.2 trillion is the estimated obligation for the future care of U.S. veterans who served in the various wars. Detailing the report for The Intercept, journalist Murtaza Hussein writes, "The staggering economic cost of the war on terror pale in comparison to the direct human impact measured in people killed, wounded, and driven from their homes. The Cost of War Project's latest estimates hold that 897,000 to 929,000 people have been killed during the wars. Of those killed, 387,000 are categorized as civilians, 207,000 as members of national military and police forces, and a further 301,000 as opposition fighters killed by U.S.-led coalition troops and their allies." The report also found that around 15,000 U.S. military service members and contractors have been killed in the wars, along with a similar number of allied Western troops deployed to the conflicts and several hundred journalists and humanitarian aid workers. The question of how many people have lost their lives in the post-9/11 conflicts has been the subject of ongoing debate, though the numbers in all cases have been extraordinarily high. Previous cost of war studies have put death toll figures in the hundreds of thousands, an estimate tallying those directly killed by violence. According to a 2015 estimate from the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, well over 1 million have been killed both indirectly and directly in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone. The difficulty of calculating death tolls is made harder by the U.S. military's own refusal to keep track of the number of people killed in its operations, as well as the remoteness of the regions where many of the conflicts take place. The researchers behind the project emphasize that while the total number of direct deaths caused by the more recent wars are less than the World Wars and the Vietnam War, the post-9/11 conflicts are different because of the long-term damage they have done to the societies and have suffered under many years of constant bombings, death, and destruction. Dr. Stephanie Sable, co-director of the project, said in a statement, "What have we truly accomplished in 20 years of post-9/11 wars and at what price? 20 years from now, we will still be reckoning with the high societal cost of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars long after U.S. forces are gone." The Cost of War Projects report arrived on the same day as a similar study unveiled by the National Priorities Project, which showed that overall spending on increased militarization both abroad and domestically in the U.S. has soared since 9/11. In that study, as Common Dreams reports separately, overall spending on increased military operations, domestic surveillance, border security is estimated at $21 trillion. An online event with the report's lead researcher, Dr. Nita Crawford, and other experts to discuss the findings of the report was held recently. Hosted by The Intercept Hussein, the panel also featured Dr. Catherine Lutz and Dr. Linda Bones of the Cost of War Project and Dr. Maha Halal of the Justice for Muslims Collective. In addition, remarks will be made by Senator Jack Reed and Representatives Barbara Lee, David Cicilline, and Ro Khanna. Speaking during the panel discussion, Dr. Halal said that the money on war spent since 9/11 is to her $8 trillion dedicated to the murder of Muslims, and I see no better way to make this sound any better or different. We talk about what will happen to the veterans when they come back, she continued. Obviously, that's important to address, but what about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone struck in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? In conclusion to her remarks, Halal quoted from the 2013 testimony of a 13-year-old boy from Pakistan named Zabir, whose family had been targeted by U.S. drones, when he told Congress, "I no longer love blue skies. In fact, I now prefer gray skies. The drones do not fly when the skies are gray." This is the cost of war, Halal said. That a young boy 13 years old can never look at the sky the same way that people who haven't been bombarded with violence can. And this, to me, is one of the things that has been totally neglected.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, I'm your host Musa Al-Bahadi, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, questions, and other relevant circumstances or topics parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself. Peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. So, dear Sayyid, our topic today is a continuation of the previous topic about the positioning of the child in the wider family unit. Last we spoke about the firstborn and the problems that they may face when the parents sort of delegate too many responsibilities to him. And now, today, we will talk about the middle child. So, dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. We said it is quite important for a parent to understand the sequence of the child, whether he's the oldest, the middle, or the last, because each of these positions amongst his siblings plays a major role. And we spoke about the older child, and we mentioned a few things that might happen that some parents might not be aware of. Now, for example, let us look at the middle child. Now, the middle child or children who are in between two siblings, for example, they're not the oldest, they're not the youngest. These ones usually have the feeling of they themselves. They feel neglected and not loved, because they look at themselves and say, okay, I'm not the oldest who's respected. I'm not the youngest who is spoiled.
Right.
True. So I am in between, I'm in a transit between, where no one is giving me too much attention. No one's giving me enough love. No one is giving me enough care. Now, obviously, as a parent, you would love your kids the same.
Right.
But the child, to the child who's in the middle, he always compares between the two ends.
Right.
Either the child who's respected, the oldest, or either the youngest, who is spoiled. And he's like, okay, what about me?
Right.
So he always or constantly has that pain inside him of not being seen. So, and obviously with some parents, sometimes they don't have enough time for the child in the middle, right?
Painful reality.
Either they give most of the time to the youngest, obviously because he needs more attention and care. And so you see the parents most of the times, the youngest one, they're constantly kissing him, playing with him, hugging him.
Right.
And the older one, obviously, because he's older, so the parents, they kind of leave him alone, which the middle child perceives as a way of respect. And he's like, okay, what about me?
Right.
I'm here. So he would constantly, he tries to seek attention. He would constantly want people to look at him. He's constantly trying to have the attention of his parents. And sometimes, because he does not understand how to deal with them, he would obviously seek it in the wrong way, or the wrong manner. It
becomes a competition for him.
Yeah, and so he will do something stupid in order for him to seek attention from his parents. And when that happens, obviously the response of the parents would be in a way of a punishment rather than trying to give him what he requires.
Right, naturally. Dear Sayyid, I will unfortunately interrupt you because we will be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing about perhaps the mentality of the middle child or middle children in a family unit. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
When we look at the middle child, for example, and we said it's important for parents to understand, and sometimes the one in the middle child, he finds it much easier for him to escape punishment. Unlike his older sibling, for example, the older ones usually, you know, they get to cope it where he says, you know, I'm kind of in between, no one cares about me, so I can get away with things.
Right.
So
I can fly under the radar.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes he does that, and he doesn't fear if he tries to do something bad. So this right. This also happens to the child when he's in this age. And also you find that the middle child as well, he does not want to compete with his older sibling as well, because he thinks, well, obviously I'm smaller than him, I'm weaker than him, there's no point in me competing. So he kind of plays that barrier between him and the older sibling. So that creates a sense of, a distance between them in terms of relationship and in terms of siblings. So when the child has all these feelings and he's going through all these emotions, it is very important for the parents to come to his aid, at least, and create that balance between him and his other siblings.
Right.
So it's very important. And a lot of parents, like I said, in the same case that they do with the grown-up by giving him too much responsibility, the middle one gets neglected, the younger one gets all the attention and right. gets all the spoiling. So as a parent, you need to understand to keep that balance between your kids at all times. So understanding which child you have and which position he's located in is quite important.
Right.
And obviously, from a boy to a girl, that will change and differ in, let's say, in strength. For example, the sense of feeling neglected for a middle child, if he's a boy, is a lot less painful if it was a girl. Girls are more emotional. When
right.
they feel neglected, their response it's really
small.
You know, it's actually not. It's more. It's more devastating. So, for example,
right.
you will find such a girl who's in the middle. She would constantly be alone. She would be antisocial. She would be like what we call an introvert. She would not communicate much with people. She's
right.
constantly preserved. She creates her own world around her because she feels that she's not part of the family. So it's very important to understand where they are situated and whether they are males or females.
And on that note, dear Sayyid, we will go on a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Be just between your children when granting things to them, in the same manner that you would like them to be just with you, in obedience and kindness."
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIV English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, and today we are discussing the importance of understanding the children's position in the family unit. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Now, if we move to the last one, right, the last spoiled brat.
The youngest one.
The youngest one. So the youngest child, usually, as we call him, the last. We Arabic, we have a term for it, Akhir al-Anqud, the last of the, I don't know what you want to call it. In terms of if you have a fruit and you're picking the fruits,
right.
it would be the last fruit to pick. And usually the last fruit to pick, it has more value to you because
right.
it's the last one, right?
The last one.
So you savor it. You,
right.
you make it last.
Right.
So with this child, so he gets extreme attention from his parents. And then the parents, they exaggerate in their amount of love and affection towards this child.
Not only that, because what sometimes I've seen is that parents, because they feel guilty about the stuff they've done with the other siblings as they were raising them, they overcompensate with the youngest one.
All that happens. That happens as well as right. So that's also very common, that the parents usually, as they go through a phase themselves, when they realize they've done something wrong with the first or the second or the third, they usually make it up with the last. And
right.
by doing so, by giving so much attention to the young one, usually that acts as a way to deprive the others from the love and affection. Because, I mean, look, if we, me and you as grown-ups, right, if we were true friends, and I see you giving too much love and affection to our third friend, I would feel a bit of shortness and nux in myself.
Like, Naturally.
I'm like, okay, so why is this brother giving him too much, you know, attention, talking too much to him, joking with him too much, laughing too much, and he hardly talks to me? I would feel bad about it.
Right.
Now imagine a child, like a young child who needs love and attention the most at this age of his life, and the parents stay oblivious to that fact, and they just diverting their attention completely to the younger one. So the rest of the siblings, they would definitely feel that they are left out. They don't have this much love, this much compassion.
That.
Yeah.
Right.
And the younger child always, he feels he's the king of the jungle.
Right.
Right? So
disrespecting the elders.
Yeah, so he does
care.
Whatever he wants to do, and no one can say no to him.
He's a gangster.
Yeah. So if the younger ones, or the older ones would do something to him, yell at him or stuff like that, you'll find the parents get upset and get angry because he's their favorite child now, right? Naturally,
right.
without, obviously, this is all happens subconsciously. The parents love all the children, but their attention is diverted to this one. And if anything happens to this one, you see the parents, like, you know, they're always defending him, they're always attacking the other ones.
Right.
And even when this little one does something stupid, like, yeah, he's a child, obviously. He's the youngest. You have to understand.
And you're older.
You
should have
You're older. Let him
so
do
on.
This.
Right.
So he always gets away with things. And he always gets away with the problems. And he feels that he has the right to do whatever he wants. And obviously then he starts to fighting with his, you know, even when it comes to his parents, whenever he goes against them, the parents would give up. Okay, he's the youngest, he's, you know, the
right.
the spoiled one. When
not
he goes
sure.
against his siblings, okay, he gets whatever he wants. So that creates, you know, you're creating,
right.
in a sense, you're creating a mini tyrant.
And you're breeding resentment between your siblings.
Yeah, yeah. So it is very distractive. It's very distracting dealing with such a child in such a manner. So unless we understand where they are situated in the list, we're going to have problems.
Dear Sayyid, I thank you for providing us with valuable information. I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Dear listeners, if you have any questions, comments, or just some feedback, please contact us at our email at englishradio@irrb.ir. You can also visit our website at parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have, on, for example, Facebook or Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all by the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.